So it's a pleasure and an honor to be here to share something to you. I was wondering, when we were thinking about come, about which kind of help could I bring here, because lots of the insights regarding this revolution we have seen in subjectivity and emotions in the last decades, of course, it has been discussed here for so much time. But the case is that we have a perspective of it from the South, and you know that the Latins are very much emotional. So maybe that's the reason I paid attention to that kind of aspect of this huge change we are witnessing now. So this is the title, The Rise of the Affective Field in the Future of the Christian Witness. I think my presentation will be a little bit different from other ones because I'm not actually going to pastoral kind of advice, but more trying to understand the whole thing, you know, the structural thing we have been following these years. And I will start with that quotation some of you maybe know from Milan Kundera, a famous writer in the 80s and 90s. He has that paragraph that is very interesting. European civilization is supposedly founded in reason. Yet we could also say that Europe is a civilization of sentiment. It has given origin to the kind of human being which I would like to call the sentimental man, homo sentimentalis. That is the expression I've been using a lot in Brazil. You could speak of the psychological man or about expressive individualism, but I like this way to put it. Ever Ilus, a Israeli sociologist, I'm going to quote here, uses the same expression, homo sentimentalis. This is a side of the contemporary subjectivity. So this is our roadmap. I will just give a short introduction, and we go to some signs of this emotional change we are witnessing, and then I speak a little bit about the homo sentimentalis, and then the main thing, the affective fields, which are a particular concern for me, and then the future of Christian witness. So as an introduction, I think it would be interesting to share the way we felt that back in Brazil. We went to England for our time in Gretham. This was 2007. And up to this time, I was teaching theology in a college and also doing church work. But I was very much focused in fighting like rationalism, new atheism. It was still up at this time. Maybe until 2005, it was really strong. We had lots of that, and I had some background in science. My brother is also a scientist, so I was concerned about that new atheistic discourse in university. So we went to Le Brie, but I felt something changing. Just before going, and I felt strongly when we were there. And I felt that the frontier of Christian apologetics was moving from epistemology to ethics, at least in Brazil. I think it happened before in Holland, in America, but we felt that happening at this time. And it was so clear to me, and it came like a shock, because I spent so much money with epistemology books when I went to Le Brie. But when we went back to Brazil, I gave up to speak on worldview, and I was speaking on happiness. This was one of our main themes just in the beginning. So when I came here back in 2010, I lectured on happiness. And I remember that Mike was there, and he did some nice questions regarding that, but I was already feeling it. This was before James Smith started to speak about the same thing. So in 2013, I started to speak on affective revolution, which I would sum up as this disengagement of modern emotional life from a moral universe and its reassignment as raw material for self-expression and well-being. So this sounded new 10 years ago. Now it's like normal currency. Everyone understands that. But I want to show you some of the clues we found that pointed in that direction. The first author, actually, I found saying something like that was a French guy, Gilles Lipovetsky. So around 93 or 4, he started to speak on the second individualistic revolution. But he saw it happening from 1950 to 1970. And this would be a mixing of modern hyper-consumption capitalism with a modern way to feel love and to organize emotions. He used that expression, homo consumericus, to explain that. But this was the first time I found that. And then I started to search for it. And I could see lots of changings in these 30 years related to a emotional revolution, like the idea of emotional intelligence, which emerged in the 90s and became like like normal currency now. So in business, for example, already in 2011, emotional intelligence tests became more important than IQ tests. And this was like in less than 10 years, we've seen that change. And it went to education, spread to the world. It's the same in Brazil as in America. So you have that last year, the OECD launched this global survey of social and emotional skills to develop new policies for OECD countries to deal with education or social emotional education. That is the expression. But now it's a global and huge thing, and they will demand from countries, from OECD, internal research to understand what's going on with the students and how can they train the teachers to assess the emotional realities of their students. And then you have positive psychology rising from the 2000s ahead from the work of Martin Seligman or Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi and other very famous guys. And I think there are lots of nice things coming from positive psychology, but this new science of happiness is a big thing. It's a big change in the way science imagines human realities and human flourishing. And you have affective computing. Some of you maybe heard about Rosalind Picard, which started that back in 1995. Is a Christian, actually. She works at this affective computing lab in MIT. But of course, she has very nice uses for treating autism, for example. But the big techs are using affective computing actually to make money and to engage the user to selling things, selling emotions, selling experiences, and making people really like dependent of the digital media and this kind of thing. So this is something to pay attention, because artificial intelligence understands, as to say, our psychology, we are going to have huge troubles with that. And then there is this narrowing of the human-animal gap, and some of you heard about Peter Singer. And he has this idea that animals have emotions and desires, so they have interests. And interests are the real basis for dignity and rights. So he founds rights over feelings. This is what is actually happening. And you have that in professional ethics, but you have that in pop culture also, everywhere. this narrowing of the distance between animals and people. This was today. I've seen some meme in Instagram. I follow that kind of thing also. And it was so funny. It started with someone saying that it would prefer, she would prefer a pet than a person. And I was curious about that. So I read all the thing. It was like a cartoon. And it had hundreds of, you know, people commenting it, like very happy and crying emotion with, I mean, demonstrating emotions, because they really supported that idea. So it just became normal. And even in the beginning of this year, the Pope complained about that. And some of you maybe have seen that. In Brazil, it was a huge discussion, because lots of people are really Catholics, and they were really offended by the Pope, because he said that it would be egoistic to prefer pets than children. But we have more serious changings. Anthony Giddens wrote that book, The Transformation of Intimacy, many years ago. It became a classic, and he presents there this idea of pure relation as a description of modern love. And pure relation means that if you stay in a relationship, it's just because you have emotional reward. And while you have that, and since it stops, you can leave the relationship. And he detected that as a kind of new standard for modern love. And another guy, I didn't mention here, but it would be interesting for you to, if you are interested in research about sex in America, is this volume from Mark Regnerus. The title is Cheap Sex. And he applied the ideas of Anthony Giddens to a national research in America about sexual behavior and the impact of it in modern love and confluent love over women and children. He discovered lots of very interesting things, and Anthony Giddens even recommended it. But he differently from Giddens, he pointed out the problems that pure relation brought to women and children specifically. And Giddens was like, he didn't want to say that something was wrong as a sociologist, but as Regnerus has shown it, he had to accept, and he gave his imprimatur to Regnerus' work. So I really recommend that book. In Brazil and in other countries in Latin America, we have that new concept in family law, the idea of eudaimonistic family. Don't know if you have anything like that here. But the idea that the point of family is to make each member of the family happy. And this would be the new foundation to think about family. And this is changing our jurisprudence and also Brazilian law. Even the language. So this is, Ruais is the second most important dictionary of the Portuguese language. And it changed the concept of family, without any reference to kinship or anything like that. It's just affections. If there's a group of people that share some place in some moments and they have affections, this is a family. And this is now in the dictionary. But we have worse, things that are worse. This judge is Maria Berenice Dias. She is very influential. She founded this National Association of Family Law in Brazil. And she became really influential as a leader of this new movement of affective rights. This is the name. I asked her about that in Europe and in America, and I know that this is not used here. But in Latin America, we have that concept of affective law. It means any kind of changing in our legislation or jurisprudence regarding the new forms of family and love, and especially, of course, the thing of equalitarian marriage and transgender rights. And so she has that famous article in Brazil. The title is Marriage, No Rights, No Duties, Only Affectivity. It's interesting to see how she makes that opposition of rights and duties for a side and affectivity for the other side. It's truly romantic. But she got really influential. And in 2011, we had in Brazil, the Supreme Court in Brazil accepted the gay marriage. Actually, it was a gay civil union. It was not called like gay marriage. But actually, it was what happened. And he quoted in his vote, the main judge related to that, he quoted Maria Berenice Dias' works and the idea of affective rights. And this was how the thing entered in Brazil. So I started to guess that maybe this was what was happening in other countries. But in Brazil and other Latin American countries, it was articulated that the thing was actually affective rights. This is what was going on. And you have in politics, I've just mentioned here, Mark Lilla, some of you know, or many of you know, I'm sure. So I knew, I mentioned that in another lecture. I knew that because of Tim Keller's tweeting about it. And I went to read that, and it was really amazing. We have in Brazil people saying the same thing that Mark Lilla said, some anthropologists and sociologists, which are not very left-wing. They have been pointing out the same thing, that this new way to do politics, he calls it pseudo-politics of self-regard and self-definition, this is identity politics, it has this effect of making the young people diving outward, or better say, not outward, going inward. So this kind of introversion in modern politics has to do with this emotional change. But this is not only in the left-wing side. So William Davies, which is a British political economist, wrote that very interesting book, Nervous States, Democracy in the Decline of Reason. And he says the same thing. There is something changing, and people are guided by fear and gut feelings. And this is happening in the left and in the right, everywhere, actually. Individual and collective worlds have been taken over by feeling. Democracies are being transformed by the power of feeling in ways that cannot be ignored or reversed. And this is our reality now. And he thinks you can't really reverse that trend. You must find ways to live with that. But that's not going to change soon. And I want to point this guy. I know that some of you maybe don't like him. Or maybe some of you like David Brooks. But I'm quoting him because he introduced me to Richard Florida's idea of creative class. And this was because of this article he wrote for The Atlantic in the last year. And he explains here how this new creative class emerged from the 2000 ahead. And they are very much evaluating creativity, to be smart, to be original. So they value intelligence, but for them what matters is to be creative. Okay. And these guys are connected to tech industry, media, arts in general. They took some good places in the bigger American cities. And you have they are very much connected to gentrification in those big cities. And he tried to describe that group, but actually he was taking it from Richard Florida's work that did it before. The point is that when David Brooks wrote about that in the 2000s, he was very much for that movement, that new class which was emerging. But he changed his mind. And that's the reason he wrote that other article last year. But the interesting thing is that other guys are saying the same. You have French writers speaking about this new class, and it has got global. In Brazil, we have exactly the same thing happening in the big global cities like São Paulo or Rio de Janeiro or Curitiba, which are very much connected to other global cities. And you know that Tim Keller has been saying that for a while already. Some of that cities are more connected among themselves than to the smaller cities inland in their own countries. It happens here, it happens here in other places. So if you find someone from that creative class in São Paulo, it's basically the same thing you are going to find in London or, I don't know, in Washington, for example. So this is happening, this is very important, because this creative class has this new affective feelings, this affective ideology as a moral basis to face life, to take professional decisions, and to organize family life. And we have, at the same time, this growing of mental health issues, and this has become huge. Also, in 2018, we had this global report from the Lancet Commission on Mental Health. This was a very important launching, this global report. They were warning about the epidemics of mental health, not respecting like economical differences, for example. So there is no so much difference from mental health troubles in Africa or Latin America or Europe. It's a global epidemic. And this was before COVID. This was before COVID. They were estimating trillions of dollars spent with mental health in the next 20 years. But we had that also in Brazil and also here in America. But there is this comment from Ole Madsen, which works from Philip Heath, with what he calls critical psychology. The study of how psychology works to reinforce our economic and work system we have now in the world. And he's professor at Oslo University, and he wrote that the depressed individual represents the involuntary reverse side of this ideal, a human being who is worn out from trying to achieve self-actualization. Actually, he criticizes a lot positive psychology, not because, the good advances of positive psychology are to be celebrated, but he criticizes the absence of self-critique from that movement. Because you have a science of happiness that appears to help the citizen to be connected to a system instead of asking about how that system is making people sick in the first time. So he called it the citizen. No, this is not from him. This is from Cabanas, but he is in the same direction. Citizen. We have now a therapeutics to make people feel okay in a system which is making them sick very much. And people that cannot really deal with their troubles, the fracture kind of reflexivity, it's appearing now. Because you have the new science of happiness and you have new numbers of emotional misery in the world. And it is happening at the same time. It must be connected. But now there is this very interesting development, and this was an article published last year in November, The Rise and Fall of Rationality in Language. It was published at PNAS by a team guided by this guy, Martin Schaeffer. He is professor at Wageningen University, and he gathered this team with guys from Eindhoven and Indiana State University. And they were studying, actually he studies tipping points. This is the way he puts that. He is professor of environmental studies. So he started studying patterns of sudden changing in weather or in ecosystem. But he went to study social groups also, and even to history. So he at some point he was comparing the duration and the crisis of many civilizations. How long would they survive, and the main troubles before a huge collapse of a civilization. So he studies tipping points everywhere. And he had a clue that something changed in the 80s. So he gathered that group, and they went to study the use of words using Google and Gram. And they researched millions of books from 1850 to 2019. Using Google. And also they researched the use of, Google searches of different words. There is an explanation for that I cannot give you now, but they found a seesaw pattern. They could identify a seesaw pattern between rationality words and emotional words. And this is what they found. You see that pattern, he describes that it's like a hockey stick. Is that right? A hockey stick pattern. And you see the tip of this hockey stick. Maybe I can find a pointer here.
Your cursor is showing up on the...
Is the cursor appearing?
Yeah.
Okay, that's it. So you have that. You know, this is happening in 1980. What they discovered is that words related to intuition, emotions, and individuality, they were going down from 1950 until 1980. And when we reached that time, it started in 1975, it goes up dramatically. And the opposite thing happens with words related to rationality, collective things, institutions, it gets down, also dramatically. And they researched the same thing in seven different languages, especially from 2004 to our times, and also pronouns. And they discovered that around 2007, even the use of the pronouns changed, with the plural ones going down and the singular ones going up from 2007 ahead. So he had this conclusion that at least two big changes. One was around 1980 and the other ones in 2007. It was like the shift and the boost of it. And he connects the second one with maybe the appearance of social media and some political happenings. We had that financial crisis in 2008. But the main thing happened in 1980. And of course, it started before. It started maybe 10 or 20 years before. The universal and robust shift that we observed does suggest a historical rearrangement of the balance between collectivism and individualism, and inextricably linked between the rational and the emotional, or framed otherwise. Does this indeed correspond to a profound change in attitudes and thinking? Clearly, the surge of a post-truth discourse does suggest such a shift, and our results are consistent with the interpretation that the post-truth phenomenon is linked to a historical seesaw in the balance between our two fundamental modes of thinking. And that's his conclusion as a scholar of tipping points, as he says. It may well be impossible to reverse the sea change we signal. From his experience, he studied that kind of thing. There's nothing you can do to change it. It's just done. So I think it fits to what other guys have been saying about his civilizational change. It's something related, and we must pay attention to that. It's not something just about leaving rationality for emotions, but also the collective for the individual. And both things happened at the same time. And this would be the idea of the homo sentimentalis. Of course, I could speak a lot about Charles Taylor here. Everyone has gone to Charles Taylor to understand what has been happening. I'm just quoting him because he speaks about subjectivization, subjective centering. It's another expression he uses, and it came from modernity. It came from, of course, from Renaissance, but it started as affirming the centrality of man, and it became the centrality of self. That was the change we've seen. But the other side of it is the place of emotions, which is my emphasis. He's speaking about romantic expressivism here. This philosophy gives to feeling an unprecedented centrality. In that perspective, an essential part of good life must consist of being open to the impulse of nature, which appears in your feelings, of course. But this is inseparable of the way I feel, from having feelings of a certain kind. Our feelings become integral parts of our most original and basic definitions of the good. If the good life is defined partly by certain feelings, then it can be untied and separated from traditional ethical codes. So that's the thing. You don't have just subjectivity. The point is that there is some kind of organic connection between subjectivity and emotivism. And every author finds something like that. Even Martin Schiffer, in his research, he found both trends to change it together. Rationality, and you have the collective. And when you go to emotions, paradoxically, you have the emphasis in individuality. But the point is that if you take yourself as reference point, the main word to explain your world is your emotion. That's the thing. So there is an organic connection between subjectivism and emotivism. Before him, Philip Heath said the same thing, of course. And I'll quote that piece of his book that is classic. Trained to be incapable of sustaining sectarian satisfactions, psychological man cannot be susceptible to sectarian control. Religious man was born to be saved, psychological man was born to be pleased. The difference was established long ago when the I believe, the claim of the ascetic, lost place to the I feel, the caveat of the therapeutic. So you have both things here, you know, the subjective centering and also the emotivistic turn. And he wrote that 2 years, this was 1966, 2 years before, of course, the 1968 revolution, which is called by Gilles Lipovetsky as the beginning of the second individualistic revolution. So here we have the emergence of this psychological man, the psychological paradigm, which is both subjectivistic and emotivistic. And then Jock can sell his books. So I would strongly recommend that book from Carl Truman. He goes to the same authors we were, actually everyone was going to, like Charles Taylor, Philip Heath, Christopher Lash, and Alasdair MacIntyre. But he brought everything together in a very nice way, that book, so I strongly recommend that. But going ahead, I want to emphasize something here that Charles Taylor says in his Sources of the Self. In our civilization, molded by expressivist conceptions, it has come to take a central place in our spiritual life, in some respects replacing religion. He's speaking about art. The awe we feel before artistic originality and creativity places art on the border of the numinous and reflects the crucial place that creation and expression has in our understanding of human life. I think this is important because when we speak about spiritual introversion and this thing of subjectivity and emotivism, we must understand the kind of ethics that emerges from that construction. And it is an ethics not just of self-expression, but of creation. That's the thing. To be smart, to bring something original and different from everyone, something new to the world. And this is so funny because this is very theological. It's like someone expressing an aspect of mannishness, we should say, to be creative, but as causa sui, as if you didn't have a God behind yourself. And you see Schaeffer saying things like that in True Spirituality. Man, having put himself rather than God at the center of our universe, constantly tends to turn inward instead of outward. He has made himself the last integration point of the universe. This is the essence of his rebellion against God. When I turn inward, there is no one to communicate with. And so, each man is himself exactly like the bull-headed Minotaur, shut up in his personal solitude in his labyrinth at Crete. This is the tragedy of man. When he turns inward, there is no one there to answer. So Schaeffer has said everything before. But you see, I like the way he puts it here. Because he speaks a lot about his irrational leap and about a first floor and second floor. But here you see that the leap is actually to inside. This is the leap that was happening. And he was aware about that. But the thing that maybe Schaeffer didn't get at his time is it's about this silence, he says. If you go inside, there is no answer. But actually, people found an answer. The voice they hear when they leap inside is the voice of their own feelings. That's the thing. And then you have critical psychologists saying exactly the same thing that Schaeffer was saying. Today, the Protestant ethic appears to have been replaced by the therapeutic ethos. If one looks at religion from the perspective of psychology as a means of orientating oneself in the world, it is not so far-fetched to view an inward focus into the self and an outward focus towards God in heaven as two different versions of the same process of searching for meaning, the need for a meaningful framework. He must have read Schaeffer. Anyway, he doesn't seem to be a Christian, but he went straight to the point. You are actually listening to a voice. It's your own voice, actually the voice of your feelings. And now we have social systems dedicated to cultivate this kind of ethics and this paradigm of moral formation. So I would recommend here another writer. He's a critical realist social scientist, Margaret Archer, and I always say that It's not Margaret Thatcher, please. I had to say that in another lecture. It's Margaret Archer. She was called the sociologist of the Pope. But she's amazing, and she developed this morphogenetic theory of social changing. And other guys followed her, like Christian Smith. He's well known among evangelicals also, but he's a Catholic from Notre Dame University. But he goes the same kind of perspective. And she speaks about culture, structure, and agency to understand things. You have culture, and that means values and liturgies and narratives, ideas, worldview, as we like to say, or moral imagination. So you have culture and you have structure. And structure are the institutions, social positions people actually have, so class divisions, this kind of thing is structural. And both things are real. Of course, they do not exist without human agency. But when there are people that understand that those structures and cultures and live by that, they have causal force, real causal force. But of course, in the center of it, you have human agency. And she is a Christian personalist. So for her, there is real agency and real dignity and everything. So she, as Christian Smith, she thinks as a Christian in that side. So it's very compatible to a Christian perspective. But the point is that we have these three realities to understand what happens when society changes. When we have a cultural life, social structures to embody and perpetuate that life, and circles of people acting aligned with culture and structure, so you have an integrated cultural system. You must have that. A cultural life, structures which embody it, and circles of people acting together, having the same interests, going to the same direction. And so things happen. So I spoke a lot about culture, and when we speak about identity and emotions, we speak a lot about culture, basically. But we need to understand the structural developments which give bones to that new culture, to like stand up. And three important structural developments were the rise of the affective fields, the new international human rights system, not new, of course, but new in history, and the rise of the creative class. And this was also core to the changes we are seeing now. So in regard to the affective fields, I recommended that book. It's also available here, called Intimacies, The Making of Emotional Capitalism. So Evelyn Luce applied some ideas from Pierre Bourdieu and Michael Walzer to explain how modern society works through like systems. And you have many social fields which cultivate specific goods that can be differentiated from other goods. So you can speak about scientific fields and scientific capital. And you have political fields and political capital. And you can speak about actual capital in the markets. And the point, she argues, is that we've seen the rise of the affective fields, which are social subsystems dedicated to build up emotional competencies, intelligence, emotional capitals, and to interfere in the process of education and social care. So she argues for that, and she develops a sociology of these emotional, or better say, affective fields in modernity. And she argues that it started in the 1920s and 1930s when the big company, American companies, discovered psychology as a way to enhance management and market. And so psychology was absorbed, and we saw a mixing of the modern consumption capitalism with techniques to understand people and to help people to be themselves. So with that merging, we have now a social structure, a social force within society working to change the moral standards. The purpose of course, the purpose of the companies was to sell more. That was the thing, to be effective. Of course, the psychologists, which started to receive financing from big companies, they were just doing their science. But anyway, that thing happened. So we have now these affective fields, which started with psychology and then pedagogy and education and management and publicity, media and journalism, and it spread around. So in some professions, it's basically that, like psychology or social psychology, for example. But in other fields, what you have is a kind of advanced posts, like in journalism, for example, or in business, when you have some professionals which are doing the therapeutic within the company. So a affective field is a network of social relationships between individuals and institutions, forming a sphere or a system of social life dedicated to the circulation of emotional capital. So this was a structural thing that happened. And this is the way we should understand movements like the LGBTK something movement. I will learn to say that in English some point. But this movement is very much connected to these new affective fields. It's not just political movement. Is therapeutics. And then you have that, the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It gave a structure to protect people in the beginning. That was the point, to protect people from abusive governments. But what started to happen in the last 30 years was this infiltration of expressive individualism within the human rights system. This was an enormous change, and is now it gave to the expressive individualism a way to interfere in different countries, even without the same history you had here in America, for example. And then you have that quote from Michael Ignatieff, which was a leader in the human rights movement globally. Human rights has become the major article of faith of a secular culture that fears. It believes in nothing else. It has become the lingua franca of global moral thought, as English has become the lingua franca of the global economy. This observation is really important, because the fact that the human rights system became the temple of modern morality, as the therapeutic ethos enters this temple, it can run the world. It becomes hegemonical. And that's the thing. So if you didn't have that structural development, it wouldn't be possible for expressive individualism to be exported like that, like changing legislations everywhere, even in countries without the same story as Eva Illouz described. And one of the tipping points of it was, of course, the Yogyakarta principles, laid down in 2007 in this Indonesian city, with its 29 principles for sexual orientation and defending gay marriage and everything. And it was renewed now in 2017, including the transgender issues. But these Yogyakarta principles, they tried in the beginning like to become international law. So they brought it in 2007 to the Human Rights Council of UN, and then they brought to a meeting of UN, but they could not get the support of all the countries. So it's not international law. But they are making pressure. And people related to that movement in each country, you can see that they are also very much related to the creative class. It's the new class that emerged. And this is another structural development we've seen in the last decades. The creative class took, for example, it happened here in America, it took the Workers' Party here. It's not Workers' Party. It used it to be the Democrats. And of course, the workers left the party because of that. The same thing happened, or something similar thing happened in England. It happened in France. It happened in Brazil. So the Lula, maybe some of you heard about him. Lula was the leader of the Workers' Party in Brazil for decades. And after they went to power, it was just when those changings were happening. And the Workers' Party became the party of the cosmopolitan young elite. Oops. What is that? Okay, let's go back here. Okay, I was speaking about Brazil. So we had that change in Brazil, that emergence of this new creative class, as in the same way you had here, of course a little after, but it has become global. And now we have a new class war between this new elite. I think I have a rebellion here. Don't know what's going on. So there is a cultural life, a moral imaginary or worldview of self. This culture has a structured support in the system of the affective fields, which do the therapeutic work of soul healing and education. And the prime audience of this therapeutic work is the creative class. And this complex forms the hypermodern cultural system. As the system grows, if it can really take the human rights, international human rights system and the regional human rights systems and make itself law, we will have a morality legislated globally. This is what is happening. So it's dark. So what is the future of Christian witness? I don't know. Of course, I believe in Jesus, so he'll do something. But I'll just give some tips about what could we do about that. I would say first, of course, I think we must pay attention to those three things. Our answer should be doxological, missional, and systemic. By doxological, of course, I speak about identity, but I think we should connect it to worship clearly and to our Trinitarian thinking. So the point is how worshiping God determines our identity. I think this is a core thing, not just in terms of ideas, but in terms of reality. I think you remember that quotation from Ole Madsen, which is not a Christian, but he noted that. There is a parallel between searching for identity in yourself and worshiping God. It's just that. It's simple like that. So I think we must explain the place of worship in the human formation and Christian formation clearly, explicitly to people. Second thing, we must be missional. And I guess you know that nice image, this icon, this Eastern icon of Jesus, the Pantocrator, Christus Pantocrator, the Lord of everything. And you know that the right and the left of the face, they are somewhat different. So this is the real image. And the point is to show like Jesus is, transcendent, and he judges our sins and everything, but he is also immanent, and he's connected to us in some form. And so the point is that we must have dialogue and antithesis in our approach to culture. And that means we have to profanate these idols. So the idea of that you cannot challenge your feelings, that you should change your feelings to make them fit to the moral reality that God has created, we must say it openly, and we must believe that, and not feel shy of saying that you have wrong feelings, and wrong feelings do not fit the moral universe God has created. So you got to have antithesis. You need to have that. You need to be prophetic about that. But then there is dialogue, and we must remember that the creative class is not a bunch of enemies. They are missionary field. So it's not about how to face or challenge the creative class and the affective fields, but how to be present among creative people and within the modern affective fields. And that means going to give a witness professionally. So we need Christian psychologists working together to be present in the affective fields, as we need in other areas. And then our answer should be systemic, and that means culture, structure, and agency. In terms of culture, the point would be a Christian therapeutic. So the question is like that. Augustine wrote from the start, he wrote a book on happiness, the happy life. And of course, this was the way philosophers would speak about a good life and about morals. And he wrote about that. Happiness is not a positive, just a positive psychology concept. It's something much bigger and interesting. And I think we should be intentional about that. Philippe Reeve said that each culture has its therapeutic. The therapeutic of a culture is the way you do the mediation between your feeling life and the demands of culture and society. Each culture must have the therapeutic class as an organ managing that thing, helping you to mediate both realities. The point of modern therapeutics is that it teaches people to search for answers inside and not really caring for the common good and going together with other people. That's the trouble with the modern therapeutics. So we should think about a Christian therapeutic. I think we should be open about that. And of course, that means ideas, but means also liturgies and other things, and narratives. And then you have structure. To act in structure, we need, I know that this is exhausting, but we need advocacy. We need advocacy in those discussions on the human rights, because as you have these huge changes, it's difficult to go back. So we need advocacy in that level. But we also need institutional embodiments of the culture we want to teach. And structural embodiments or institutional embodiments should be like of course, the traditional thing, families, churches, schools, Christian organizations, but especially, of course, churches. We should not lose our hope in the importance of church. Kuyper said something like that, that the light which is going to illuminate the world will come from the windows of churches. He said that. I still believe this is just right. So we need institutional embodiment, and we need therapeutic intelligence. So we have that in that therapeutic culture. You have these affective fields and professional people working in those fields. So we need also networks of Christians working in that fields to help Christians to do the same mediation. There's no way to escape from that. So how to connect my feeling life to a moral world? Of course, for the secular therapeutics, there is no moral world. You just use that, you know, to answer to your feelings. But for Christians, this is in The Abolition of Man from C.S. Lewis. There is a moral order. And real education teaches your feelings to love the good and to hate the evil. That's the thing. So we need a therapeutics to do that. Not just moral sermons. You need more than that now. And you need agency alignment practices. What should be that? So you have a class, like the creative class. So you have people that do things together. They go in the same direction. They have similar interests. So even when they are not totally aware about that, they are acting together. And this alignment of agency is what makes a culture embodied in a structure to become social force. This is the way things happen, actually. So we need gather people to align agency. And how can you do that? So basically, you need narratives to align imagination, liturgies to teach behaviors, and you need the habit of cultivating good together, and that builds community. In terms of shared narratives, I would strongly recommend Life in Communion from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and he has this amazing chapter in the end of the book when he speaks about reading the Bible together, and he says that we actually found ourselves in the story. Our salvation is found outside ourselves, extra nos, not in my biography, but only in the story of Jesus Christ. So our main response to the new identity culture, and I'm speaking about culture here, of course we need lots of things, I'm saying that, but the core thing is the story. Our weapon against the lies of the therapeutic culture is still the story, the same story. We must receive and inhabit that story and tell it and listen to that story together. And it makes very much difference because people start to imagine their future actions together when they are receiving the same narrative. So this is really core for me. And then we have the shared liturgies. Some of you know this German author, Hartmut Rosa, which wrote lots about resonance and how our fragmented culture lost resonance. And he uses that metaphor to explain these moments and places where we do things really together. We become one socially. And we live in an atomized society. And one of the ways it is atomized is just that everyone does its own thing. That's it. Liturgies are just the places we do things together. So, and this is the thing, in the Christian realm, evangelical one, I must say, We had for decades this idea of being an authentic Christian and not religious and not like tied to liturgies and traditions and doing the same thing all the time and sacred calendars, because to be a Christian, a real Christian, I remember that expression I heard from two Americans in different moments. To be in a church doesn't make you a Christian, as to be in McDonald's doesn't make you a hamburger. Yeah, I agree. I can't disagree. But of course, this emphasis in authenticity, there's something sick in it, just that. And, you know, it was spread around the world, and people started to believe that instead of following the religion, cultural and social forms, we must have authentic Christian experiences which are unique. It's your experience, and you are going to change the world because you have had that experience, that special thing, you know, that special calling. And this is just a translation of the therapeutic culture into the evangelical culture, and it was exported to the world. So everywhere you have that culture of evangelical authenticity, the next step is secular authenticity, just that. So we should think about liturgies. Rituals promote resonance axis, socioculturally established throughout which vertical resonance relations with God, cosmos, time, and eternity, horizontal in social community, and diagonal toward things, become experienceable. And that's the point of shared liturgies. You stop to do your thing, and you are doing the same thing other people are doing and that your parents did and other generations did. And of course, there is beauty in you can have beauty in liturgies. Of course, it can be something that. It doesn't need to be. But I think this is really important. And I'm not speaking about liturgies only in terms of church, Sunday liturgy, but about a Christian year and the meaning of the steps in God's work in history of salvation, and you repeat that throughout the year. And you have the day. I would recommend here Tish Warren speaking about today. And finally, we need shared goods, what Oliver O'Donovan describes as common objects of love in his lectures, at his top lectures. And he quotes Augustine, "If a people is an assemblage of reasonable beings bound together by a common agreement as to the objects of their love, then in order to discover the character of any people, we have only to observe what they love." So the point is that we must gather people to take care of things together, to take care of the garden. And this would be something that I think would resonate to lots of young people, and we have some experience with that. So when people are loving and taking care of things together, this is a way of alignment. And as they recognize the good as a good, really as an objective thing, they can make promises, and something new can happen. So these are just some tips about how to answer to it. I don't think we can change this modern culture. I don't want to be pessimistic here, but I believe we should just give a witness and not have the expectation of like taking power and changing everything. But we must show something real. And I would say a Christian therapeutic must shift expressivity for responsivity. Instead of the homo sentimentalis, our paradigm should be the homo respondens. So that's the point. How to respond to God's reality and to look outside instead of looking inside.